let me in. Shiba chiba. I wanna be closer to you. Shiba chiba. Open up your soul. Shiba chiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, and sometimes understand something. This next interview is archived from 2025 back in June, so I hope you enjoy it. Scintillating scientist envoy here to talk about their branch of science in a way that you understand it. I'd like to welcome Jenny Serrano Rojas. Hello.
Hello, how are you? Hello.
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. Excited to be in the radio.
I'm excited for you. So, Jenny, before we talk about what you do, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, when did you realize that you were interested in science?
Okay, thank you for the question. So, I am originally from Cusco in Peru, from the Andes. Although I was not maybe exposed to like the diversity of the jungle, we are still in the Andes, we have a lot of diversity. And my house was surrounded by nature, which gave me the opportunity to observe interactions, species, and even like one of the things that attracted me the most was the frogs. And this cycle that goes from egg to an adult, it goes from egg to tadpole to an adult. I realized I wanted to learn more about them, understand why this was happening and how this was happening. And then I find out that maybe becoming a biologist was one of the ways to achieve that. So that's why I decided to pursue my career in biology.
Okay. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. So, Jenny, when you were in high school, when you were going through the earlier grades, were you still interested in science or did it happen more later in life?
So I was interested, but I didn't see many opportunities or I didn't see anybody like, for example, studying animal behavior. It was mostly, everything was mostly theory. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was not a thing for me or a possibility for me. But then when I went to undergrad and I could see like maybe more, like I could read some publications and I could hear about other people's research, then that's when like it went back to me and it was kind of like, maybe I can do this in the future.
Ah, okay. So you're in your undergrad. And where did you undergrad? Where did you go to school?
I went to school. My university is in Cusco. So mm-hmm. It's San Antonio Abad del Cusco. That's the name of my university.
Okay. So in your undergraduate studies, you saw that these papers. And how did you make the transition to biology, like describe that.
So like when I went to my undergrad directly, in Cusco we have to choose the degree mm-hmm. before we apply for the program. So
okay.
I when I went in, I went for biology, like straight into biology.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you study biology, are there particular branches that you study or is it sort of a general... Is it just sort of general?
Yeah, it's like it has branches.
Mm-hmm.
So after, like maybe after half of the course, then you have to select what is most interested for you. And one of the things that I choose is ecology, because ecology studies these interactions between animals and then animals, plants or organisms and the environment. So that's something I really wanted to look in more.
When you're going to school and you choose your branch, then do you immediately start doing research or is it still more theoretical?
So yeah, but back then it was a lot of theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really hard. Also, like it was really hard for me to find opportunities because most of the opportunities back then were given to laymen because there was this assumption that men maybe could perform better in, like, for example, the jungle, the place where I really wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So after finishing my undergrad, I got an opportunity to go as a volunteer in a program that was studying different animal groups. And that was, like, key for me to here studying more, like, for example, now what I do, I study frogs.
Okay. So when you went in that into that program, that research program, were you the only woman or were there other women there with you?
I was mostly like the only Peruvian in the program. And it was in Peru. It was in the jungle of Peru. And most of the researchers were, it was like female and male, but everybody was international. And I was the only Peruvian.
Okay.
And they were interested in including more Peruvians in the research. So that's how I got the opportunity.
Very cool. And so you say that back then they mainly just gave it to men. Have you seen it change over time, over the short period of time?
Yes, no, it has changed a lot. Like, I did my undergrad almost 10 years ago. So, and then I worked for 10 years in the jungle. So, like, now it's much better. There is a lot of more opportunities. And now, even in my own research, I try to be, like, equal. And, for example, when I offer positions as a research assistant, I always try to have women and men in my team. And I try to have a mentoring group in the university. So trying to help and push people or female biologists who want to go into, like, the research path to continue.
That's great. That's great. So it sounds like you have maintained your interest in frogs from the get-go. Was there any time where you looked at animals other than amphibians, or did you stay with frogs and them the whole time?
No, actually, like, when I was little, although I saw amphibians and they were very interesting, I was also watching some documentaries. Like, one of the famous ones is Animal Planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so interested in monkeys. So I thought in my future career I was going to be studying monkeys. I was like, when I went to the jungle, I didn't know much about frogs, like, especially from the diversity, because in Cusco I could maybe only see, like, a couple of species. Mm-hmm. But then in the jungle I was seeing, like, 20 to 30 different species, different colors, different sizes, different calls, different behaviors. So that is what, like, trapped me into wanting to study frogs.
So during all of this, did your parents support your desire to go into the sciences?
Yes, I was very like my parents. Oh, there is not much opportunities in my home country, like, for being a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents were always supportive. Like, I always was good in my grades and I always achieved different things that they were expecting. So they were always, they knew, like, whatever I achieved, it was going to be okay. So they have been, like, the key piece in me being able to continue.
So where are you right now? Are you here in the U.S. or are you still in Peru?
So I am at Stanford University, so I am living in California.
Oh, okay. So you're local. So what do you study here in the U.S.?
I am doing my PhD. Mm-hmm. My doctoral degree in ecology and evolution.
Okay.
In the biology department.
And explain to our listening audience what your research entails.
So since I was so interested in frogs and on their behavior and also their conservation, so my main focus is trying to understand the responses and adaptations of frogs to global change.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this in three chapters. So the first one is looking to the response along an elevational gradient. So seeing how climate change is affecting them.
Okay.
The second one is looking into seasonality. So I look how poison frogs, in this case, are responding to dry and wet seasons.
Okay.
And the third part is looking into how these poison frogs are responding to and land use change. So I look to their behavior, space use, the resources they need in a primary forest, in a bamboo-dominated forest, and in an agricultural land. So together with this information, I am trying to understand how they are adapting to the current changes and the information that we need to create new policies and work in conservation for them.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a little break right now. And when we come back, we're going to continue speaking with Jenny about poison frogs, because as we all know, children love poison frogs and they're going to want to hear a lot more. So while we do this, let's listen to Voss and Bearer of the Cups. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. It's Scintillating Science Monday, and we've got Jenny Serrano Rojas on the line. We're trying to work out the sound issues, and I think we have. So let's get back to poison frogs. Now, as my question to you is, have you noticed, because I know I've noticed, have you noticed that children love hearing about poison frogs, and adults for that matter?
Yes, like I am very happy every time I give talks, because as soon as I show my slide with all the colorful poison frogs, everybody gets like, oh, I want to hear about them.
Yeah.
So, yes.
They're beautiful. So you're in Peru. Were you surrounded by poison frogs? And are there other types of frogs besides the poison frogs, or is it largely poison frogs in the Peruvian jungles?
So in the area where I was working, just in the, like, let me tell you, like maybe 800 hectares mm-hmm. of forest, there is like 60 species of poison frogs.
Wow, that many.
And within, yes, and within those species, like, are maybe in like 12 families, and one of those families are poison frogs. So actually there are many, many, many other, like, other frogs, other families, other species, other adaptations. So poison frogs is a small group, but it's still larger in comparison to other countries as well.
Okay. In your research, what have you observed to be what's happening with frogs and climate change?
Okay, so in this chapter that looked into the climate change, I was comparing data from now, data on the elevational distributions of frogs now and 10 years ago. So I wanted to see if similar to other species and also similar to predictions, there is this prediction that says as the temperature will increase, species will move up, higher up in the elevation, so they can find similar temperatures that they were adapted to. So that's the prediction. So during this, my first project, I was able to observe these ships. So species are actually moving, some of them, but some of them are not moving. And the abundance, so the number of individuals of these species, is also changing. So what's happening, or what it seems to be happening, is that some species are not as strictly, they don't necessarily need bodies of water for survival because they have this direct development. So there is this group of species of genus Pristimantis. So in contrast to all other frogs, they don't have the tadpole stage. So it only goes from egg to a baby adult, basically.
Oh.
When it hatches, it comes out a frog. Like, it is just small. So these frogs don't need the water because they don't have the tadpole. So a lot of them are moving up slow, so shifting into higher elevations, but also some of the same species within the same group are not doing that. So it's not clear yet, but there is competition. So some of them are better adapting to a new environment and are exploiting more resources, but some are not able to do that. In the case of poison frogs, they do need the water. So I haven't seen my species, the species that are in the area, like moving up slow. They are staying in their range. So, and one of the potential explanations is because they still need these bodies of water that are reduced as you go up in elevation.
Okay. So with these poison dart frogs that are just born looking like frogs.
No. So sorry. I think... So not poison frogs. There is other frogs, group of frogs that are the Pristimantis, is the genus, is the group of these frogs.
Okay.
So those are the ones that can hatch from the egg. It just hatch a baby frog.
Okay.
It doesn't have, it's not a tadpole. It's a small, very small frog that just needs to grow.
Okay, but the poison frogs, they have a tadpole stage.
Yes, and that's one of the most interesting things in poison frogs. They have this parental care. So, like, there is many species that, for example, after they have the eggs, they just go away and they don't care anymore. But in poison frogs have to take care of their eggs and the tadpoles. And the eggs, they usually have the eggs on the leaf litter, so inside the forest. And when the eggs hatch and grow a little bit, these tadpoles are ready to go to the water. So the parents, in most of the cases, is the male who will carry these baby tadpoles, on the back to a body of water that is sometimes maybe 10 meters away, but sometimes it's maybe 200 meters away. So they can navigate the forest to find these bodies of water for the tadpoles.
And about how many tadpoles are attached to the backs of these parent frogs?
It's also really variable. So there are some species, like Dendrobates tinctorius, that lives in Suriname and French Guyana. They usually have only between 2 to 4 eggs.
Oh.
But they take, in the most of the cases, they take only one tadpole on the back, because they not only use pools or like water on the forest floor, but they also use holes on the trees. So they can climb like up to 20 to 30 meters along a tree. So they only carry one tadpole. But another reason why they only carry one tadpole is because the tadpoles are cannibalistic, so they can eat the brothers or sisters.
Oh.
They try to put the tadpoles in separate, like, body waters.
So are they taking them up one at a time, or are they just choosing, like, their favorite tadpole and everyone else has to, everyone else is on their own?
They, what they do is that they have to, they have to take one at a time.
Okay.
They take one and then they come back for the rest.
Okay.
But that's one of the, well, that's a few species. Like, a lot of the species will take up to like 15 to 20 tadpoles on the back.
That's a lot.
So there is this huge variability in like how many they take.
And has there been any decline in the poison frog population due to climate change?
Yeah, definitely. Like, there is, like, especially, so, like, for climate change, there is not, like, a clear understanding what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are, although they are not moving, they are staying in the area. But the biggest problem is the land use change, because as they lose habitat, then there is less key resources, such as water bodies, for them to take their tadpoles. So land use change is really affecting the population right now.
Okay. So in addition to that, are with the fall off in population, I know they're poisonous, but are they, do they have natural predators that survive by eating them?
Yes, yes, for sure. So the, also the level of toxicity, the level of the alkaloids they have on the skin. So the first, like the alkaloids, they don't burn. Like, they are not born with these alkaloids. They need to eat to be able to have these alkaloids on their skin and become toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the frogs in the labs, here in the labs at Stanford, they don't have any poison. They don't have any alkaloids. But frogs in nature, they do, because they eat different insects, or like many insects that they give them the alkaloids. So this, the level of this toxicity that is in their skin is very variable. So like some are like very harmless, but there is other species that can be very dangerous. So there is this species in Colombia. Its name is Phyllobatis terribilis.
Mm-hmm.
And if we use the whole alkaloids from only one frog, that can be used to kill up to 10 people.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, but for example, the ones in the ones that I study in Peru, I can touch them even sometimes with my bare hand and nothing happens.
Wow.
So this level of toxicity is also incredibly variable. And many of them are like that, like are harmless to humans.
So so they're eating, are they eating things that are toxic that makes them toxic? Or is it a chemical reaction when they eat a particular bug? How does that work?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So it's not completely clear,
mm-hmm,
where all these alkaloids are coming from, but so far, like a portion of them have been found in the diet. So, in ants, mm-hmm, mites, mm-hmm, beetles, so they eat things that have these alkaloids. There is a lot of studies going on right now, like how can they sequester these alkaloids from their diet and take it into their skin without killing themselves, without getting like toxic themselves. So there are these proteins that are like holding these alkaloids and are taking them into the skin glands. So far we know it comes from the diet.
Mm-hmm.
We know only a portion of these alkaloids in the diet, but we don't know where are the other ones, like where are the rest of the alkaloids. So there are still a lot of studies trying to understand where all of these alkaloids are coming from. But so far, we know most of them are from the diet.
Okay.
When they are not exposed to the nature and they are like for example, in a terrarium with flies, only eating flies, they would not have any alkaloids. So they cannot make it. They need to grab it from somewhere else.
Okay.
They have proteins in their bodies that allow them to sequester these alkaloids and take them all the way to their skin.
So I want to go back to the one that can kill 10 people. Is it simply by touching them that you die, or is it more complicated?
Yes. So indigenous communities in Colombia use the secretion of the skin of these frogs for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that there has to be an open wound for the alkaloids to go into the system.
Okay.
So, like, researchers here, like, people that I know work with this frog wouldn't just go and grab the frog, like, even if they don't have a wound, because we don't know how much the absorption of the alkaloids for just grabbing the frog could be, but it usually requires an open wound, something that is going to allow the alkaloids to go into your bloodstream. So it's not that easy. Like, it will have to be... So, yeah, they are not dangerous. And this poison frog, this Filobates terribilis, right now is only inhabiting a few areas in Colombia. It's an endangered species, so it's losing a lot of habitat. So, yeah, they are not dangerous, but they have these, like, very important alkaloids on their skin.
Okay. In Peru, these poison frogs, are they considered a point of pride, or are they considered... pests, pride or pests?
No, they are, in Peru, it's interesting this too. Like, a lot of people, local people in Peru or close to the areas where these frogs inhabit, they don't know about the existence of sometimes this diversity. So when they find out, we try to come together to create these plans of how to conserve frogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the tools we use is poison frogs, because they are so beautiful, so attractive. And also we try to explain that they have these different adaptations. And also they are important in general for research. So we create this position for them that make them very important for their environment. So that, for example, one of the poison frogs that I study is endemic of the region where I work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only found in this region, nowhere else in the world.
Oh.
And that's something that sometimes people don't know, and when they find out about that, so they feel so proud, like, to know that, okay, this poison frog lives in my habitat, and that's amazing, and I want to protect them. So that people feel very attracted to protecting poison frogs. And I know some projects in the center of Peru that also use poison frogs as the flag. Some species that can be used as to feel proud and to want to protect an area because they are beautiful, because they are important, and they are playing important roles in the ecosystem.
Okay, so I've seen yellow poison frogs, I've seen red, I've seen blue. How, like, what range of colors are there in poison frogs?
There is black, there is green. For example, let me just tell you, my frog, Amerega shiwemoi, is its name. And this Amerega shiwemoi has a black dorsum and then two orange lateral stripes. The belly is blue with black patches. So that's one color.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is called Amerega macero. Amerega macero is, the back is red with black on the back. And then it has two white, very bright green lines on the lateral side. And again, the belly is blue. And there are other ones that are, as you mentioned, orange, red, blue. This poison frog that I mentioned has only four eggs and take the tadpoles all the way to like 20 or 30 meters high on the trees. They can be blue with black. They can be blue with yellow and black, or they can be black with yellow, or mostly yellow with a little markings of black. So there is so much variability in the coloration.
And is the variability, if it's a red frog, are they going to have mainly red children, or is it just random what color they're going to be when they grow up?
So there are studies of that as well. And yes, it depends on the parents, like the variability of the colors. But so there is a big diversity of them in just one place. And then when they have tadpoles and then baby frogs, they will acquire some characteristics of their parents. So there is also these poison frogs in Panama. Mm-hmm. They are different. It's the same species, but there is different morphs. So there is blue, red, and other colors. And then they, although they are closer in the area, they have these different colorations. And one of the reasons is the parent, like they know, is the parent, so like genetically. But another reason is super interesting as well. There is this thing called imprinting.
Mm-hmm.
So if the tadpoles sees that, because in this species is then the mom takes care of the tadpoles. So the mom will go back to the area where the tadpole is in the water and lay some unfertilized eggs and feed them. So if the mom, for example, they will see the mom, so they will recognize the color of the mom, the mom. So when they grow and they will choose a partner, they will select a partner that is the same color of the mom. So that's how there is this evolution of like changing colors or having different colors of the same species in different small subpopulations. So they did this experiment in which they have these tadpoles, but they show them a different parent, like of different colors. So when these frogs grew older, they were choosing the one that the receptor showed to them. So showing this clearly imprinting information when they are babies.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
I love that. No, that's like the greatest frog story I've ever heard. It's like you can just show them a different mom and they're like, okay, when I grow up, I'm going to marry that. So.
Yes. That is so crazy. Sometimes it's like all these incredibly adaptations and information they can gather from a very tiny.
So, Jenny, if people want to find out more about your research, where can they go online to learn more about it?
I'm currently writing my papers on these poison frogs, but I need to publish still this like my findings. Mm-hmm. But one of my mentors who taught me what I do to study poison frogs is I use telemetry. I wanted to So how I study my poison frogs is I use telemetry.
Mm-hmm.
So I use frog panties for the frogs. I put these
frog panties
with frog
you're,
panties.
You're just
yeah,
now telling me about frog panties?
Yes. So the frog panties are these teeny tiny panties that have a tracking device. So I place them on the waist of the frog for 10 days.
Uh-huh.
So I can find the frog like multiple times a day for many days. And I know where they are, what's the space they are using, how much they are moving, what resources are important for them. So biotelemetry is very key in my research because it allows me to follow this behavior that otherwise like is very difficult to gather because it's so difficult to find the same species multiple times without having something to help you, like a tracking device. Because the jungle is so complex and, there are so many structures, so it's difficult to find those. But I use these frog panties that allow me to do that. And one of my mentor who taught me how to use these frog panties and telemetry with frogs is Andrius Papakonis. And then he has a lot of papers on frog tracking. I have been working with him. I have some papers with him. And he's looking more into this ability of the frogs to transport their tadpoles to like 100 meters away from their home and how they can navigate the environment and come back home. So there are so many cool findings and cool questions that he is answering like with these tracking devices as well.
I love that. You heard it here first, people, frog panties. With that, Jenny Serrano Rojas, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for this amazing opportunity.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, and I'm still feeling some Fats Waller.
Why don't we get along. Everything I do is wrong. Tell me what's the reason I'm not pleasing you. I may kiss you, but then you say kiss me again. Listen, baby, tell me what's the reason.